It's the summer of 1970. Sam Cunningham, he's the older brother, Randall Cunningham. He's looking forward to his first season as a fullback at USC. And there's a date on the schedule that jumps out right away. September 12th, 1970, first game of the year, first time in 24 years that two big-time programs, USC, where he plays, and Alabama, are going to play each other.
Sam Borden is a senior writer for ESPN.
What makes it especially interesting to Sam, though, isn't just Alabama. It's where the game's going to be played, in Birmingham. Now, at that time, 1970, any black player will tell you, the prospect of going to Alabama and playing a game there is a very fraught proposition. Remember, we're only 2 years removed from the assassination of Martin Luther King. So Sam goes to his parents and he says, got any advice about me going down to Alabama?
My dad, I asked him about what I should do and how I should act. And he didn't say anything for like about 10 minutes. So I looked at him. I said, man, did you hear what I said? And he says, yeah, I heard what you said. And he looked at me and he says, don't do anything stupid.
It was 50 years ago that the Alabama Crimson Tide, made up entirely of white players, hosted the USC Trojans, a racially integrated team with an all-black backfield. The game became legendary for moving the needle on racial equality in sports. But the half-century mark of this matchup falls in a time that's historic in its own right, with renewed debate on racial justice and police violence, and college athletes speaking out. Today, four players who took the field in Birmingham in 1970 share their story and measure the progress that's been made, or not. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, September 17th. This is ESPN Daily. This story of the 1970 game between USC and Alabama, it's been told many times and in many ways over the last 50 years, and a certain mythology has grown around it. But you approach it differently. Before we get into that, can you just break down for me what makes this particular game so meaningful?
Yeah, Pablo, I mean, obviously, when you talk about a subject like racial integration, it's complex, it's multi-layered, there's a lot to it. But this game between USC, which had an all-black backfield, three guys, quarterback, running back, fullback, go into Alabama, which was an all-white football team and had been for a long, long time, that's seen as a seminal moment, a tipping point in the sport. It was sort of the moment where everyone finally realized, okay, what's going on in the SEC with, you know, a vast majority white players on vast majority of the teams, that's going to change. And I think when you look back at the history of the games that made that apparent, this is the one that people point to as the biggest tipping point along the way. But the thing that I found so fascinating was, like everything else in 2020, things feel different now. And so when I talked to the players who were involved in this game, they said what's going on in the world right now, the reckoning with race that's happening in the United States, that's given them a new perspective on this game that they've been talking about for half a century.
So who did you end up talking to for this piece?
So I talked to four players. The first is Sam Cunningham. He was the fullback on the USC team. He was the star of the game, scored all the touchdowns that people remember. And like I said, was part of that all-black backfield. How did you end up at USC?
I wanted to go there because they were going to the Rose Bowl like every year.
He went on to play for the Patriots, played his whole career with the Patriots in the NFL. And one of my favorite things about him is his nickname was Sam the Bam.
A tremendous diving fullback, Sam the Bam Cunningham.
The second player was the quarterback on that USC team, Jimmy Jones.
All right. Hello, my name is Jimmy Jones and happen to play quarterback for the University of Southern California.
He had been on the team the year prior, had led USC to a really successful season in '69, was on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
the real reason that I went to USC was because there was an opportunity for me to play quarterback relatively early. At that time, being a black quarterback was a difficult thing, so trying to select a school that was going to be honest about playing me was a task.
And what's interesting about him is that he didn't go on to the NFL, even after playing in this important game for racial progress in college. When he was ready to go pro, the NFL was a long way from accepting black quarterbacks the way that we see now. So he ended up not even getting a look in the NFL and played professionally in Canada, which I always thought was sort of an interesting continuation on for a guy that was in this game. Then from Alabama, I talked to Scott Hunter, who is the quarterback.
I'm Scott Hunter, and I was the quarterback of the Alabama football team.
He went on and played for the Packers, the Bills, the Falcons, the Lions, and now lives back in Alabama.
That Southern Cal game, after that, I don't think anybody could have any question that it was time to go out and start getting good black players to play at Alabama.
I mean, then the last guy that I talked to was Johnny Musso.
My name is Johnny Musso. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, played for the University of Alabama under Coach Bryant,
who was the running back on Alabama.
We had a history of being very good and excellent, but the times my first year or two there, we were struggling just to be mediocre.
He had a pretty successful career in the NFL, went to the Chicago Bears and played alongside Walter Payton, and then went on to live in Chicago for most of the rest of his life.
There has been a good deal of speculation that the legendary Alabama coach Bear Bryant, the king of the SEC, that he scheduled this game for very particular reasons, reasons that went beyond typical scheduling considerations. What do we know and what don't we know about his motivations there?
It's tricky because I think there's a school of thought that says, okay, Bear Bryant was this immense figure in college football.
If we do that as a team, 11 at the time, 4 years from now, we'll be walking out of here as a national champion. And I'll tell you this, I expect nothing less.
And in addition to being an incredibly talented and successful coach, he also played a huge role in helping to integrate football teams racially in the South. And I think it might be a little too simplistic to say that. It was clear, we know for sure, that he was interested in bringing black football players to Alabama before 1970. Sam Cunningham told me that he got a letter, a recruitment letter, from Bear Bryant several years before that, and at the time laughed at it.
There's really no way I'm leaving Santa Barbara to go to Tuscaloosa and try to fit in. I mean, I probably could do it if I absolutely had to, but I didn't absolutely have to.
Bear Bryant, we know that he was interested in doing that. We know that in the stands that night, the night that USC and Alabama played in 1970, there was a freshman scholarship player that Bear Bryant had brought to Alabama who wasn't eligible to play, but was there. And we know that at that time, there was a lot of pressure from the governor, George Wallace, who was a outspoken segregationist.
Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
As well as many members of the board at the University of Alabama who were pushing hard to keep the all-white policy in place. The interesting thing about this game in particular, though, is that McKay and Bear Bryant were close friends. They played golf together in the offseason. And in 1970, the NCAA had put in a rule that added an extra game on the schedule. Most schools said, okay, that's no problem. We'll just kind of add in a game against a team that's close to us or, you know, pick up a sort of an easy win. McKay and Bear Bryant, the story goes, got together that winter and said, hey, why don't we do a home and home series where you'll come to Alabama in 1970, we'll come to California in 1971. So was this in the back of Bear Bryant's mind when he was scheduling this game? I think it's fair to say that it certainly was on his mind, but I don't know that he went into it and said, that's going to pave the way for me to finally have an integrated roster.
What did USC's black players tell you about how they felt making this trip?
I mean, the first thing they said, Pablo, was that they were scared. And I think it's important to understand what was going on in Alabama at that time. You know, we're a couple years removed from Martin Luther King Jr. being assassinated. We're 5 years removed from Bloody Sunday and the March at Selma. A few days after this game, Birmingham police are exchanging gunfire with members of the Black Panthers. I talked to Jimmy Jones, and I remember very clearly him saying,
"We understood what time it was and what period of history that we were in. We were young, but we weren't that young. And as we got closer to having to go down there, you could see people's anxiety start to ratchet up a little bit."
Were you part of any conversations about guys saying, like, look, we need to protect ourselves because this is a different environment that we're going into?
Yeah, there were conversations. People talking about, man, do you think we need to take any weapons to protect ourselves? Yeah, I'm taking a gun with me, man. I remember Tony saying that vividly, that, yeah, I'm going to take a gun with me. And we kind of laughed it off. As legend has it, he did have one with him. Other people had taken some knives along with them and those kinds of things and had them in their suitcases just in case.
So in spite of all those fears you outlined, they do make the trip. And when they actually arrived, did any of those fears materialize at all? How were they received?
As it happened, when they got there, what they found, I think, was a little bit more of, as Sam Cunningham described it, sort of gawking at them.
We had a walkthrough, I think, the night we came in, and I think about 4,000 or 5,000 people showed up for that. So it was kind of like some people come to the zoo to see the animals and what was going on out there.
Even before they could get to the game, they really had to sort of get past the novelty that they were in this city. I remember talking to Jimmy Jones, and he said one of his teammates, Charlie Weaver, was sitting in the lobby of the hotel, and an Alabama local comes up to him and says, "Hey, would you mind if I touched your skin?" Charlie Weaver, I guess, was a dark-skinned, very, very dark-skinned player, and this guy literally wanted to just touch his skin. And Jimmy Jones said that Charlie Weaver was sort of surprised by it.
Did he let the person touch him?
I think he did. I think he wanted to see whether it was going to rub off or something. Charlie tells the story that way. He said, "I think he wanted to see whether my color was going to rub off on him or something of that nature."
Then, you know, later that night, the players are in their rooms, and Sam Cunningham hears a knock on the door just down the hall, pokes his head out and sees a couple of Alabama fans who are knocking on the door a couple doors down. And John Papadakis comes to the door. Papadakis is white.
John opened it and asked them why they're here. And they said they wanted to see, you know, they probably used the N-word. And John said, "Well, I have one right here."
Papadakis brings the kids into the room, and Ken Carter is the teammate, lets them sit down and talks to them for a couple of minutes. And, you know, they have these sort of weird interactions that obviously wouldn't be part of your typical day before the game routine.
So that's the prelude to the game. But on game day itself, set the scene for us there.
The bus to the stadium goes through an all-black neighborhood in Birmingham. They look out the window and they see men, women, children, boys, girls on the street corners, on the porches, cheering for their bus.
It was like we were in a parade. And the bus was slowly going down the streets, and we were going through some of the African-American communities, and people were out on their porches and out of the streets waving and wishing us well. They were seeming to be more joyous. It was like, you know, the cavalry had come to town to save us or something of that nature.
They're not cheering for the Alabama bus. They're cheering for the USC bus. These folks in this neighborhood, they can't buy tickets to the game. They can't go and watch the game in person. And they let the USC players know that it meant so much for them to see a team with an all-black backfield, a team with an integrated squad going to play against Alabama.
That ride, it kind of set in that, you know, we're down here to win this game in behalf of the University of Southern California and the mighty Trojans. But we're also down here to win this game for our people.
All right, after the break, I want to talk about how the game itself resonated throughout Alabama and into the Southeastern Conference and well beyond.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So this was all happening, let's recall, in Birmingham, Alabama. It was a big deal. The game was even moved to a larger stadium there instead of the Crimson Tide's usual home in Tuscaloosa because there'd be such a huge crowd. Sam, we've heard from USC players leading up to game day. What was Alabama thinking going in?
I remember talking to Scott Hunter, and he was saying, I was just interested in playing USC.
I got a call from a Birmingham sports writer, and he wanted to know if I knew, and of course, what my thoughts were. And I told him I'd always watched Southern Cal since they were on television, Rose Bowls and UCLA regular season game, and told him I was a big Southern Cal fan. We just played pretty much in the neighborhood, and I was tickled that we were going to get a chance to play a team from the West Coast during the regular season.
You know, in the buildup to the game in that moment, the focus really was more on the novelty of these two big powerhouses meeting as opposed to an integrated team coming to play against an all-white team.
So I want to get to kickoff and the perspectives from the guys actually on the field itself. Let's stick with Alabama first. A powerhouse school, but they'd had a few tough seasons at this point. How did they come out of the gate?
You know, they might have been a little bit delusional in some sense. Scott Hunter said that he was imagining it was going to be a shootout kind of game.
I just thought we were going to have a game like a 38-35 type game, like where, you know, whoever kind of scored last would win the game.
How would you describe the way the first half actually went?
Well, I made a joke one time. I said, gosh, I think Southern Cal was up 21-0 before we even got the ball.
USC just jumped all over Alabama, and the star of the night was Sam Cunningham.
Once he started running the football, everybody in the stadium noticed him. Sam, of course, I just remember standing there on a third and five or six or so, and I'm thinking, okay, we're about to get the ball back and so forth, and all of a sudden, he gets an off tackle, and our linebacker just cannot take and get him down.
It's funny, when I was talking to Johnny Musso, who's the running back for Alabama, I said, hey, what do you remember about your guys' performance when you had the ball? And he said, honestly, I don't remember anything about when we had the ball because I was so transfixed just watching Cunningham do his thing.
I just remember Sam Cunningham just running over us like we were little kids. Just being, you know, a Superman almost. He was bigger and stronger and faster than all our players.
Our defense just couldn't stop them, and we weren't even in the game literally after the 5 or 10 minutes of the first quarter. We just simply weren't in the game with them.
Sam Bam scored 2 touchdowns in the first quarter. He ends up with 135 yards on 12 carries. Alabama as a team has just 32 rushing yards for the entire game.
Their black guys were bigger and faster and stronger than us, and their white guys were bigger, faster, and stronger than us. And if they had any polka dot guys, they were bigger, stronger, and faster than us.
So Alabama is getting stomped, and players recall Sam Bam doing said stomping. But what about the USC side and Sam Cunningham himself? How does he remember it?
You know, I think for most of the USC players at that point, it was about the football. They had gone to Alabama expecting to face a really tough team, a really storied program. And I think, honestly, they were a little bit surprised by how easy it was for them in the first half of that game. I even remember Sam Bam telling me,
our coaching staff, when they told us about this game, they didn't dwell upon the things that were happening around the game. The first score of the game, you know, I had room to run, and next thing I know, I'm in the end zone. It's a touchdown. And from that point on, you know, we played pretty well.
But when you look at a player like Jimmy Jones, he's the quarterback. It's his job to see the big picture. And so I think even as the USC team was having this great success, Jimmy was very aware of this other component that was a part of the game, and he was making sure that he was keeping control of his teammates and making sure that any tensions that existed didn't get out of hand.
One of the offensive linemen came back and it indicated that someone had called him the N-word off the defensive line of Alabama, and really was ready to kind of lose it a little bit and get into a fight. And I said, you can't do that. You can't do that. Get focused. And I remember telling the offensive lineman, I'm going to call about three blasts in a row, and that's going to give you guys a chance to double-team that guy, and you can take your frustrations out that way. So we were able to answer the N-word without getting anybody thrown out the game and get better satisfaction by running a successful play than anything else.
And so at what point does the victory and the significance of that victory start to sink in for the USC players?
You know, it's interesting. By halftime, Jimmy Jones was saying to me that he felt like he was cognizant of the margin, as opposed to worrying about, okay, is Alabama going to be able to come back on us in the second half? He was thinking in his mind, hey, I was on that bus. I know what this game means to black folks in Alabama and what it might mean to everybody in college football. And so it doesn't mean nearly as much if we win by six. You know, he said, we're going to keep the gas down. We are going to make this the blowout that it needs to be. And we're going to make it the statement that it needs to be.
So you really couldn't have asked for anything more. You're coming down there to leave Alabama by leaving a mark and leaving the African-American fans down there feeling really good about what happens.
By the end of the game, it's 42-21. USC gains nearly 300 more yards than Alabama, has 12 more first downs. And at the end of the game, the fans in the stadium are quiet.
Whatever was on the table, whether it was Alabama as a university and a powerhouse football program, whether it was the social issues that were on the table, whatever was on the table, that night we were able to silence everything.
I want to dive into the brain of Bear Bryant now. How did he go about making sense of what had just transpired?
You know, it's funny. One of the urban legends of the game is that afterwards, Bear Bryant went to the USC locker room and took Sam Cunningham and brought him over to the Alabama locker room. Bear Bryant put Sam Cunningham up on a pedestal in the locker room and says, guys, this is the future of what football is.
The story is that I was put up on the bench in my jock strap, and every one of the players came by and shook my hand. Well, I don't remember any of that.
The legend became the truth for many, many years. I think Sam had to finally, he told me he finally had to tell somebody, no, that did not happen that way.
I mean, that's the urban legend. And if you make a movie, yeah, you put it in the movie because that's part of the mystique. But in real life, in real time, no, that didn't happen to me.
It was a lot less dramatic than that. I think that after the game was over, Bear Bryant went over, congratulated John McKay, the coach of USC, congratulated the players on USC, and sort of moved on at that time with what was going to turn out to be a fairly mediocre season for Alabama. But I think it's also fair to say that the ground had been softened up by what everybody saw that night. And all of a sudden, you were starting to see some folks around the Alabama program who were a little bit more open to the idea of, hey, if we want to continue to compete and be successful in college football, we need to look at the talented black players that are out there that right now we're missing.
So how exactly did things start to change inside this fortress that is Alabama football?
Well, there's no doubt that change when it comes to something like racial integration is going to be slow. But let's start here. The next season, 1971, when Alabama goes to USC to play the return of this home and home, they have a black player on the team, John Mitchell, and he's a big part of Alabama winning that game against USC in 71. But it wasn't like there was massive integration overnight. USC, when they came to Alabama in 70, they had 18 black players on their roster. And it wasn't until 1977, 7 years later, that Alabama even had 15 black players on its roster.
When you talk to these four players, two from Alabama, two from USC, when they look back on this game, 5 decades later now, and all the narratives that have built up around it, how do they feel about the legacy of the game?
There is no doubt that all four of them, and I would guess almost all of the players that played in that game, felt immense pride about being a part of a game that was such an important part of history. But I do think that it's complex. It's conflicted. And it isn't just the USC players. Johnny Musso, too, he said that when he looks back at the game, one of the things that he feels is regret. Particularly what we see, what's going on in society right now, he wonders if, did it do enough?
The only thing I would regret that didn't make a bigger difference, that we're still where we are in our society, particularly these last months and with racial tension and racial justice being such an issue. I think we're all want that day to be passed where we're still grappling with these type of issues. It's just sad and disheartening.
Sam Cunningham points out, I think very fairly, that, you know, it wasn't like all of a sudden Bear Bryant and all these football coaches wanted black athletes to come in because they realized, this is wrong. No, it was they wanted to win football games.
It seemed like it changed everything. But those young black men that went to those universities were invited to be a part of those programs were still black men. The only way they were allowed into that university because they could help those programs win. So did it really change? Or was it just convenient? I guarantee you that the black players that Coach Bryant recruited to come to that university shortly after that football game happened, he had to guarantee those black parents that he personally was going to take care of them and watch over their lives. Because nothing about how the white folks had thought about black folks, it changed per se. It was just the fact that you could help us win football games.
Sam talked about watching what had happened to George Floyd, watching what had happened to Breonna Taylor, watching what's happened to Colin Kaepernick. He's in California. He said, I just can't believe that 50 years later, this is happening to a black man for speaking his mind.
So how far has anybody come to a certain extent? You know, they're not sticking dogs on anybody, but they're standing on somebody's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds.
Jimmy Jones said, look, you know, I look at what's happening with Black Lives Matter. I look at what's happening with the protests that are going on right now.
It's a direct line that runs through that all those experiences. And until we come together as a race of people and as a human family, then that line will continue to run. It's going to be an endless line.
If that line stretches 50 years, it feels like it might go on forever. And if that's the case, then how important were any of those moments along the way?
And some of the gains that were made from what we did 50 years ago have been eroded and we've slipped back, taking 5 steps forward and 4 steps back. It's about the history that's being made today that's really important because that's going to have the greatest impact on the future.
Sam Borden, thank you for clarifying and critically analyzing that history here with us today.
Thanks, Pablo.
Coming up, the Big Ten made a big reversal, with plenty of risk and reward for the country itself involved.
V Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. Morty Shapiro, the president of Northwestern, was asked yesterday why he voted to play football next month, reversing the Big Ten's prior decision to hold off till spring due to this pandemic. And he wanted to make something clear.
For me, it wasn't about political pressure. It wasn't about money. It wasn't about lawsuits. And it wasn't about what everybody else is doing. It was the unanimous opinion of our medical experts.
It wasn't about politics. That was the very first thing Shapiro said about the new 8-game season starting October 24th. And this was echoed by another quote from an anonymous Big Ten president who told NBC News this: Trump had nothing to do with our decision and did not impact the deliberations. When his name came up, it was a negative because no one wanted this to be political. Well, it's more than a little late for that. For weeks now, President Trump has been making the Big Ten saga overtly political, calling Commissioner Kevin Warren on the phone, and then declaring that the conference's return was on the 1-yard line. And then just yesterday, tweeting, quote, "Great news. Big Ten football is back. Have a fantastic season. It is my great honor to have helped." And it's no secret why. The Big Ten is the Midwest. It is Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin, all swing states, in a presidential election that takes place precisely 10 days after the first of those 8 games. And Trump clearly knows that. And so does his opponent in that election. Joe Biden had been running campaign ads in those Big Ten states, explicitly blaming Trump for the absence of college football on account of his whole handling of the pandemic. But now college football is back, and great honor is being claimed. And as much as those university presidents try to disavow politics, you kinda have to be blind to ignore all those thumbs on the electoral scale, no matter what the motive for yesterday's reversal may honestly have been. Because yes, many players do want to play, no doubt. And yes, their amount of medical risk may well be lessened now, thanks to a newly promised regime of daily rapid COVID testing. But the even bigger story here is that those unpaid athletes are being moved around like this enormous political football, like an object, as usual, to be exploited by those in power. And nothing less than their health and their country are on the line. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.